deficit. Erin Gellings is a junior at UW-Stevens Point.
Students need to realize that this isn't just an attack on certain majors, it's an attack on the UW system as a whole. We need to stick together and have our voices be heard.
Amy Hassenberg, a spokeswoman for Governor Scott Walker, said the current budget included a $100 million boost for the university, and the tuition freezes make college more affordable. Mary Lee Williams, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers lost to Cleveland 6-2. Cubs beat Miami for the sweep of the series 13-4. The White Sox lost to Pittsburgh 6-5. Tonight, the Brewers on the road to play the Rockies in Colorado. The Cubs and White Sox are off. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, May 10th. Partly sunny for the morning hours, cloudy for the afternoon. High today, 67, inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Pretty good cloud cover right now. Wind from the west-northwest at 12. 58 degrees in Racine, 59 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. More information available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are really delighted to welcome back into our studios Nan Calvert, who joins us once a month to offer up a program devoted to the environment around us and designed to get us thinking about the environment, to the way in which everything around us is interconnected, and the impact that we have on the environment around us and what we can do, in a sense, to lighten our footprint on the world, as it were, sometimes thinking globally and often thinking very locally in those terms. Today, Nan has brought with her a special guest from right here at Gateway Technical College, and I'm really sorry that we've let 5 years go by without having on the morning show Callie Johnson, who is the program manager for the Center for Sustainable Living right here on the Kenosha campus of Gateway. And this is a marvelous place that everybody needs to visit, particularly if you care about the environment and want to learn more about it. And we are excited to have Callie with us in the studios to give us more details about what the Center for Sustainable Living has to offer and the difference that it has made in the community and certainly here at Gateway. So, Nan Calvert and Callie Johnson, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Nan, tell us what prompted you to issue this invitation to Callie Johnson today and what connection with or awareness of you have with the Center for Sustainable Living?
Well, Earth Day, actually, is what prompted me to offer the invitation. You know, there was a wonderful Earth Day event here at Gateway last month, and it was very well attended. And, of course, the Center for Sustainable Living was involved in that. And it occurred to me that it's sort of this wonderful but quiet entity in our greater community that a lot of people don't know very much about. And so I thought, I think we should have them on the radio if they're willing to come on the radio. And yes, she is willing to come on the radio.
Very good. And I think this is terrific. And I should mention also that the Center for Sustainable Living is actually really close to the radio station right here. So it feels like they are our neighbors, and yet it sort of feels like a million miles away because it is also sequestered in a beautiful wooded sector of the campus that is just out of the way, which makes it absolutely perfect. But a place that, in a sense, you need to seek out. You don't just blunder past the Center for Sustainable Living. It's ever so slightly hidden, but that's part of what makes it especially beautiful. Callie, before we talk about the center, let's find out a little bit about where you are from originally and maybe your professional path leading up to your appointment as program manager at the center, which I believe was 5 years ago.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm originally from Montana. That's where my family is. I attended the Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. I got my undergraduate in sustainable foods and bioenergy systems. It was a brand new program there.
Now, did anything in particular galvanize your interest in that, your desire to go into that? Did you grow up in a home, for instance, where that kind of thing was very important?
Yeah, my family definitely took a special awareness about environmental issues. They were always recycling. We composted a lot as little kids. We had gardens all the time. My mom was very conscious of that. And my dad is an environmentalist. He loves insects. We always were out in nature identifying things. So I was very close to the natural world in that sense as well. And then my choice to go into that, I was always into culinary and food and then a little bit of nutrition. But my advisor at college had told me about this cool program that connected those interests to sustainability and environmental matters, and I was sold on that.
Wow, very good. You know, Montana is a beautiful state, but it's also not the first place that we might immediately think of as a place where one might go to school and find marvelous, sophisticated programs about something like sustainable living. And I suspect, in fact, it's exactly in places like Montana where such things exist and where there is this deep appreciation and understanding.
Yeah, everyone there is very connected to their environment. That's probably their favorite thing about Montana, really, is taking care of the natural environment. And Bozeman, specifically, has a very strong culture of sustainability and just getting back to taking care of the earth and living a natural, healthy life.
Very good.
It was a good place for that.
So upon graduation, was this job at Gateway the first thing you took, or did you have a post before Gateway?
Yeah, this was pretty much right after graduation. I worked with my family. They have a property management company for a little while after graduation to kind of get my footing after that. But once I moved to Wisconsin, this was the first position that I took. So I was really happy to find something that aligned with what I had gone to school for so well.
Right. Did you miss the mountains?
Oh, always. I go back a couple of times a year to see it.
I'm sure you do. Well, we are excited to have you here. Can you give us any idea of the history of the center ahead of you joining it? That's one thing I don't recall is actually how long the center has been open.
Yeah, so I believe Gateway has used the building for about 9 years. I want to say that it was up and going about 4 years before I got here. Mm-hmm. And it was somebody's home. They had 5 acres of land up there, the house, so the barn, and the garage, beautiful wooded area and an orchard. And a woman just lived up there. And when she was ready to retire from having to take care of all of that land, she approached Gateway with the offer to use the building for educational purposes. So Gateway's been really fortunate. The Gateway Foundation actually owns the land, I believe.
Ah.
And so we lease it from them. So the house itself has been kept very similar to a residence. A little bit of remodeling has taken place so that it's more of a open learning center, but it's still, when you approach the building, it feels like you're approaching somebody's house still.
Right.
So you can get a feel for what it's like to live in a sustainable house.
Right. And we should probably explain, because I think this is one of the most interesting things about it, is the many ways in which this is, we could call it a greenhouse, I suppose, in that, that it is a real example of green design, and many of the materials of decor and decorations and so on are all, in a sense, sustainable in one way or another. Just kind of take us through the home in terms of physically what comprises it and the ways in which this represents a green structure inside out.
Sure. So it's really neat that it was an original, I believe it's 1960s house. So we didn't start from scratch with all new green materials because being sustainable is about using what's already there. So we kept the structure. A lot of the cabinets, the trim, that sort of thing is all the original. But the main things that we focused on were energy saving things. So the roof is new. We have a steel coated roof that is really great for saving energy. You don't lose a lot of heat through the roof, and it's made out of recyclable materials. We've got new windows, so that's where you lose a lot of heat in your home, is through poorly sealed windows. We have energy systems that were put in. So a solar panel, a wind turbine, solar hot water, and a geothermal heat system are in the building. So it's all very sustainably run on all of that sustainable energy. And then as far as other finishings in the building, the floorings are all really neat material. So there's sustainably harvested wood flooring. There's a neat natural linoleum called marmoleum in the kitchen. There's a really cool cork flooring in the conference area. All of the carpet, just like throughout the rest of Gateway, actually, all of the carpet is made out of recycled plastic. So that's a really neat material. Countertops are made out of recycled glass or compressed corrugated material. All of the appliances are Energy Star. All of the paint is low or no VOC. All of the light bulbs are LED, as are throughout the rest of Gateway. And then the main thing in the building that's really cool are all of the displays that go into it, as well as one room that I can talk a little bit more about later, is the interior design room that the interior design students here at Gateway get to redo every year. So they actually put in a lot of really neat sustainable finishings in that one.
Right. So what does it mean, for instance, when you have a piece of furniture that is made out of, I think you said, sustainably harvested wood?
Yes.
What does that term even mean?
So there's a lot of things that go into sustainability. A lot of people think just the earth when they hear sustainability, but a sustainably harvested forest is going to be also conscious of the workers that are harvesting that wood. So they're getting paid a fair wage. They're focused on the environment after they leave that forest, so they're not polluting the waterways that are of use to the local people. They're not destroying habitats of the animals that live there. They're replanting the forest, making sure that they leave it the same or better than when they got there to take the wood away.
I see. As opposed to just sort of normally harvested wood where someone just comes in and chop, chop, chop with very little thought for what they are leaving behind them.
Yes.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today not only with our good friend Nan Calvert, here for her monthly visit to the program, but with Callie Johnson, who is the program manager for the Center for Sustainable Living, which is located here on the campus of Gateway Technical College. If you drive onto the campus, and if you know where the Horticulture Center is, the Center for Sustainable Living is back behind there in that sort of wooded area that we don't often think about or just admire from a distance. But if you make your way back there via the pathway, you will find the Center for Sustainable Living, which is a beautiful little place that in many respects is an example of how one can live sustainably. And but beyond that, all kinds of other educational opportunities and offerings that we're going to be getting into in just a moment. Actually, I think before we proceed, because you started to do this, I think I should give you an opportunity to explore this a little further. This notion of sustainability, and obviously it's in the name of the facility that we're talking about, It is a concept that I would hope most of our listeners have a really good acquaintance with by now. But for the sake of anybody listening who really does not understand what we are talking about, explain just what is wrapped up in this term. And Nan, please feel free to join in as well with your thoughts on what it means to think of the world and think of our lives within this framework of sustainability.
Sure, definitely. So sustainability, like I said, there's all sorts of ways that you can think about it, but it's really just the interconnectedness of everything, of humans and their impact on the environment, and then what the environment can do for us. And I think we really lose sight of that when we're getting into all of the bigger economic things about how we can, our impact on the environment is going to come back and affect us. We can't just keep using all of these resources with no consequence. So it's really a nice thing when we are treating our resources well, they also treat us well. So we live a healthier life when we are trying to be good to the earth as well.
There's an educator and an author whom I greatly admire, Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she's written some wonderful books. And if you don't know her, you really should Google her. She's amazing. She sort of abandoned the term sustainability or sustainable for reciprocal relationships and reciprocity. And it's about both parties ending up better for the relationship rather than it being one-sided or the scales tilted more toward one side. And I think that's a really good way to think of sustainability because, as Callie pointed out, it's not just benefiting the earth, but it's also about the other living things on the earth, and that would include humans. So are working conditions safe and clean and fair? Are people being paid a good wage instead of being exploited? Are the resources that are being extracted not being stolen, as it were? You know, all of those kinds of things. It goes into reciprocal agreement, reciprocal relationship.
So you think when we think about sustainability, we should really take it to that degree? I mean, we should be thinking about even all of that.
Yeah, we have to, because there's well over 7 billion humans on the planet, and our planet isn't getting any bigger. All right, so at some point in time, we're going to have to think about how we can set the scales right so that we can have clean water forever, whatever forever means, so that we have functioning productive soil, so that we have drinkable water for people and other living things as well. We have to start thinking about those things, you know, about 50 years ago, but, you know, it's never too late.
We hope it's never too late.
Yeah, we hope it's never too late.
Right. Back to the Center for Sustainable Living, and we've been talking mostly about the main structure with it, which is this, I think, 884 square foot home, I mean, where somebody once lived, and a home that has been, in some respects at least, transformed into a really impressive showcase for all kinds of ways in which homes can be built and furnished and powered in sustainable fashion. There's more to the center physically than just that. I know that there are a couple of other small buildings and some grounds that are also intriguing and inviting. Tell us more about what physically surrounds the main building of the Center for Sustainable Living.
Sure. So as I mentioned before, it's on 5 acres of land. So we've got a small nature trail in the back. I want to say about half of the land is forest and natural prairie. So there's a nice nature trail. It's got 5 stops along the way. We were fortunate to get funding to develop all of that with really neat activities out there. So that's a really cool place for community members and school kids to come out and learn about nature. There's the orchard out there. It's a very old orchard, but it does produce apples every year. So nobody's in charge of those. So if you want to come pick apples, go for it. And there's the bee barn. So Joe and Kathy Madrigano have been really big supporters of the Center for Sustainable Living. They provided a big endowment for us to provide activity supplies and transportation to school groups, and then they are also responsible for our bee barn. So this is a really neat new thing that we have up there. We can't keep bees within the city limits of Kenosha, so we don't have live bees, but we have a lot of neat activities and displays, information about how important pollinators are to us and what we can do for them. So those are the highlights on the property, I believe.
Very good. I hadn't heard that. You can't be a beekeeper in Kenosha?
No, you can't keep bees within the city limits.
What a strange ordinance.
Wow. I mean, obviously we want there to be bees, but apparently the city doesn't want there to be too many bees in one spot or something. Oh, so interesting. So, yes, so the Bee Education Center then is a place that that people can come and learn a lot about bees and their important role as pollinators. You touched on this earlier, but I would like you to go into a little more detail about the kind of energy that is used at the Center for Sustainable Living. And I know you mentioned geothermal among them, but I think you maybe mentioned more than that. Explain the sources of energy that, in a sense, power the center and that people can learn more about at the center.
Definitely. So we have a solar tracker. It's located right by the Madrigano Auditorium, so you can usually see it if you're on our campus. That is a giant solar panel that just follows the sun throughout the day, so it's not stationary, only collecting sun during the morning or afternoon.
Okay, so in other words, it's getting very potent sunlight on a sunny day, at least, all day long. It's
maximizing our use of one solar panel all day long.
Cool.
So that is where the bulk of our energy comes from, our electricity. We have a neat touchscreen up at the center that tells you exactly how much energy that produces. It updates every couple of minutes throughout the day. So
that
you can,
solar panel?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So
how large
really
is that solar panel?
Roughly. I don't know exactly. I want to say it's probably like 12 feet across.
Okay.
So it's decent sized.
Yeah.
And then we have solar hot water. So if you have ever been to the center, you know there's solar panels right in front of the building. And everyone thinks that's making our electricity, but that's actually our hot water heater.
Ah.
Those typically would be mounted on a rooftop. We just have them down on the ground so people can get a better look at them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really neat source of hot water. It saves you a lot of energy because hot water heaters are a big energy draw in your house otherwise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We do have a wind turbine, but it's mostly here for learning purposes because it's very rarely actually turning. It's a model that's good for residential areas because it's only 30 feet tall, but because it's only 30 feet tall or surrounded by trees, so the wind doesn't actually do anything for us here.
Not much.
But it's cool to look at.
Right,
see a different option for a wind turbine. And every now and then in the winter, it does seem to spin, which is nice because that's when we are producing less solar energy.
Ah, right.
And then, of course, the other energy system we have is our geothermal heat. So that is the newest energy system. It was installed a couple of years ago. And it's really wonderful. It provides radiant floor heating in the building as well as forced air. We originally had a gateway program initiating the project, but that gateway program is no longer happening. The geothermal well drilling, I guess, can now be part of any well drilling, so that program wasn't needed any longer.
Mm.
But it's really neat. They put a couple of wells in our backyard, so they're deep, just like a water well would be, and we draw heat out of the ground to heat our building with that. So it's a really neat system. The furnace is in the upstairs of the center with a glass panel, so you can kind of see the inner workings of it. It's a really neat way to heat the building.
This is an energy system I really am curious to know more about. My sister, in the home that she built in Northeast Iowa, has geothermal.
Mm.
But that's about all I know about it. I mean, every time I visit, because it's way down in the basement, completely out of sight, it never even dawns on me to ask her to show it to me and explain how it works and so on. So I've already learned a little bit about that from you. What is the means by which the heat is drawn up actually out of the earth? I mean,
so there is a pump associated with the geothermal system. So the pump pumps usually a water and chemical mixture, so it won't freeze in a closed system down into the ground, and that brings up the heat that's in the ground.
So you send it down into the ground, it heats up, and then you bring
it
back
up. And then our furnace is converting that heat into forced air, or that just runs through the pipes in our floor for radiant heat.
In fact, who would think of that. I mean, I'm amazed that anybody would even have conceived of such a thing being possible. And it sounds like that is more and more workable. I mean, a more and more viable option for people to be thinking about.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So now let's talk about some of the programming and what happens at the center, not just what it is when it stands there with nobody there, but the whole point of the center existing is not just for it to be looked at, but for it to be used. On your website, I noticed that the center is described as a living and learning laboratory.
Yes.
So tell us more about that.
All right. So what we do at the center is really focused on three different areas. We focus on K through 12 school groups, the community members, and then the gateway community, so students and staff here. So for K through 12 school groups, that's really the bulk of my time is spent with them. I bring groups in for field trips, like I said, anywhere from kindergarten through high schoolers get to come up and learn about something sustainable. It can be anything that they're focusing on in their class at the time, from sustainable energy. They can check out all our sustainable energy systems to sustainable food systems. We're right next to the horticulture department, so they can tour the urban farm and learn about composting and growing local food, to environmental and ecological things with our nature trail. They can learn how to identify things and see what our immediate impact is on the environment. Or just maybe learning about how to live a green, sustainable life by touring the building and learning how to make products that they can use in their everyday life that will reduce their waste. So there's a lot of really neat things that students can come up and learn about and then hopefully take back to their families and integrate into their communities to spread the love of sustainability a little more. Mm-hmm. So that's the K through 12 group. The community members, I try to do a monthly workshop every month. Those usually go through, I want to say spring through fall. I don't typically do them around the holidays. Our next one is on May 30th from 4 to 6. It's about zero waste and reducing your waste. We'll have a short presentation about our waste problem and how we can fix that, and then there'll be some hands-on activities where people can make toothpaste out of coconut oil and glass jars. They can make bees wrap instead of saran wrap to use in their kitchens. There'll be a lot of cool options to take home. So that's the next one on May 30th. And then throughout the summer, we'll probably have more bird workshops. That's usually our biggest draw is Rick Fair with the Hoy Audubon Society. Oh, yeah. I believe he was here recently.
Yep.
He does workshops up there quite frequently, so there'll probably be some beginning bird workshops to look for in July and August.
Fantastic. And then I understand that you sometimes have summer camps as well.
Yeah.
What's that about?
So typically I do a week of camp with the Boys and Girls Club about sustainability. So the Boys and Girls Club will send some students interested in that up 1 week during the summer, and we'll do everything from make birdhouses and bird feeders to creating their own compost and planting seeds to maybe making solar robots and identifying insects. We're all over the place that week. So they get to touch on a little bit of everything. And I also try to do just maybe half day camps for community children to come in, so a parent or grandparent can bring their kid in to maybe make recycled paper, do some planting, do some nature painting, all sorts of different sustainable crafts. So those opportunities pop up. They'll be on the website, and they're typically advertised in the local papers as well.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Sounds like a busy place. I mean, we described it in such sort of quiet, idyllic terms. It's buzzing with activity in many different respects. When you have particularly young people coming and visiting, I wonder what your sense is between now and, say, 5 years ago. Do you see any increase, first of all, in just sort of awareness and kind of a general interest in some of these issues and matters? I suspect that maybe 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, the typical young kid would probably not have any of this on his radar. One would hope that by now a lot of youngsters are starting to think about this maybe more than they once did. Do you have any sense that we're making progress in that respect?
The the biggest area I've seen is that environmental classes and eco clubs have grown. So that gives me hope that more children are interested in that. There's still, you know, when a group of third graders comes to the center, they may or may not have ever heard the word sustainability still. But once you introduce them to that and kind of point out things that they do, a lot of them are saying, yes, we absolutely recycle at home, or yes, we have a garden at home. So I do hear more kids, once you explain the idea to them, they start to recognize what they do in their everyday life that is sustainable more.
Right. Now, and I know that you've done a lot of speaking to youngsters. What do you think are the most important things to think about in terms of trying to frame this in a way that captures their imagination and makes sense to them and makes it seem like this is something they should be thinking about and caring about?
I think it's just all about connection. When they can connect what you're presenting in the classroom, whether you're in their classroom or they're in an outdoor classroom, when it becomes a real life example to which they can relate, then it really sticks. Then they get it. Even when they're really little, they get it. So it's really important to begin weaving this into everyday life. You know, as environmental educators, we get these sort of one-shot deals sometimes. And that's why summer camps are so important, because you have the kids for several days in a row. Mm-hmm. Or programs like the Mighty Acorns program is so important, because the kids come out in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and they come out three times a year, and you're in the classroom before and after the field study, and so they begin to build a relationship, and then they make the connection. They can see that their stewardship activities have actually had a very positive effect, whether they're doing it at school or in their own yards or at the field study site. So it's all about connection and relationship.
Right, and seeing with their own eyes the difference that can be made. And that can only happen over time.
I mean,
the changes we make, the most meaningful changes don't happen like that, and nothing changes like that. But when they can see the...
And I always have to remember, because, you know, for those of us who do environmental education, sometimes it gets a little bit depressing, and you wonder if you're really making a difference. And the wonderful former executive director of Riverbend Nature Center once told me that our job as environmental educators is to plant a seed and walk away. You may never know when or how that seed germinates, but you just have to trust that it will, hopefully.
Right. Very good. Kelly, I wonder also, when you are talking about some of these matters of how we can build things and make things and create things that are much more sustainable than the standard way of making things. I think once upon a time that was a really tough sell, and maybe to some extent it still is, because in so many instances we're talking about things that are not cheap. Mm-hmm. I mean, that often the environmentally sensitive alternative to a standard product is going to be something that might be 2, 3, 4, 5 times more expensive than just that regular old thing made out of normal plastic that is destined for the landfill.
Should be abnormal plastic.
Right. So what kind of progress have you seen since the days that you first began studying this seriously? I mean, are some of these sustainable alternatives starting to become a little less ferociously priced and a little more within reach of just, for instance, the everyday ordinary American who might care about these kind of things but doesn't have a huge wallet and unlimited resources to buy some of these things?
Sure. So that's definitely an issue, especially with the bigger picture things like sustainable energy. You can't just plunk down the price of a car for a solar panel every day, even though it'll reduce your energy bill for the next 30 years. You have to really be a big picture, long-term thinker. And even the small stuff, like reusable water bottles and reusable kitchen things, you're going to pay a little bit more than the disposable ones, but that'll be a one-time price. You won't have to keep buying it. So you will see an impact on your wallet, again, over the long term, even though it is a little bit painful right at the beginning. But I have seen a lot of green and sustainable things become a little more mainstream. There's more companies popping up that are trying to cater to the everyday American that that really have good sustainable values and care about the environment and also care about the customer that they're trying to get. You just have to be careful of things that are greenwashed in the larger economy, where a company suddenly jumps on the sustainability bandwagon with one product that they're trying to promote to you as sustainable, and it may or may not be sustainable, and the rest of their products are still hurting our environment. So you want to be a vote with your dollar and put it where you care the most about, so that the companies do hear us and start providing more reasonably priced things that are good for the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you could reach into people's lives and really compel them one way or another to make changes, what are some of the most significant ways in which people could make changes in just the course of their everyday lives that would really make a meaningful difference for the Earth? And I am especially interested in some thoughts that you have on things people might do that are just beyond the ordinary or just beyond the obvious, because there's certain obvious things that just about all of us are very well aware of.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things that I've been focusing on recently is reducing food waste. I don't know if a lot of people realize how much food waste they have. They throw away that pack of strawberries or spinach that was at the back of their fridge for a long time. One of the biggest ways you can reduce your food waste is to have a plan, meal plan, and just purchase what you need and use that. So you have to grocery shop a little more frequently, maybe, and you have to be conscious of if things are going to go bad and make sure that you eat it. You don't just go out to eat 5 days a week when you bought groceries for those 5 days. But food waste is a really big problem in our country, especially household food waste. It's not just the grocery stores and restaurants that are causing that problem. And of course, single-use plastics are a huge one. So when you do go grocery shopping, look for the vegetables that aren't all shrink-wrapped, because they don't need to be shrink-wrapped. So support the companies that are providing things with little packaging or cardboard packaging that can be composted, that sort of thing. So again, composting will help with food waste. If you do have food waste, you can compost it and send those nutrients back into the environmental systems rather than into the landfill. But that's probably the easiest and biggest impact thing that a lot of people can do right now. There's big ones like reducing your travel. Don't fly as often. Don't drive as many places. I know that can be really difficult to reduce, because that's just the way that we live now. We're in a global economy and you have to travel. But just to be conscious of if that's really necessary, or if you can combine trips, things like that, to reduce your carbon footprint that way. It's really important.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you mentioned when you studied all of this that your interest and your studies were tied up in matters of nutrition? Can you remind us about that? I mean, is that the program that you studied in Bozeman? And what was the nutritional element? How does that all fit together?
Yeah, so in Montana, the growing season is short and it's mostly wheat. But we were focused on growing things that would be nutritious for us, that would be local, and then a seasonal diet. So how can you advise somebody nutritionally to eat a local, sustainable, seasonal diet when you live somewhere like Montana, where it's wheat and beef for the most part? So we were learning different growing methods for climates like Montana. We were learning maybe how to preserve foods that are good during the very short growing season there, so that you have them the rest of the year, and then just how you can think about your nutritional needs throughout the year by selecting things that maybe didn't come from quite as far away as other options. So maybe California or Mexico as opposed to New Zealand, just so that the footprint of your food is a little bit smaller as well.
I want to be sure before we finish to have you say a word about Gateway itself and Gateway's commitment to being a little more sustainably minded in many of the decisions that it makes as a large institution. And I'd also be curious to know what role, if any, you and or the center have played in some of the choices that Gateway has made in terms of its own footprint on the earth, so to speak.
Sure. So Gateway is really wonderful in its commitment to sustainability. That's been going on for quite a long time, even before they started their sustainability initiative at the college. They were actually doing a lot of sustainable things here. So as I mentioned, talking about the center, the rest of Gateway is also using like LED light bulbs and recycled plastic bottle carpeting and that sort of thing. There's sustainable things on all of the campuses here. We've got some form of sustainable energy on almost every campus, I believe. Like there's the wind turbines out on Racine. There's a wind turbine at the Horizon Center. There's solar hot water in Elkhorn, all that sort of thing. There's little things like the water bottle fillers all over, so you can bring your reusable water bottle and not have to buy one out of the vending machine. And they're really good about focusing on hidden things as well. So policies, cleaning supplies, lawn care, sourcing things. When there's construction projects, they make sure that all of the debris from that is recycled properly so that the waste is reduced. They're really into trying to reduce carbon footprint of traveling. So we're always looking at if we can reduce people's commutes by maybe having more phone calls rather than traveling to campuses. They're really great about looking at all areas of sustainability. The center is an offshoot of Gateway's sustainability initiative. So the center hasn't really had a big impact the other way, but it is a nice centerpiece of Gateway's sustainability initiative where we can really showcase what we care about here.
Wonderful. Nan, do you have any questions for Callie before we finish up?
No, I just wanted to thank her for mentioning reducing the number of single-use items you have in your day or your week or your entire life, because you know, that was born out of so-called convenience and marketing. And unfortunately, too many of us have been convinced that that's the way we need to go. And so I have to confess, I cringe when I see people buying huge amounts of bottled water that's swathed in plastic. And I want to ask them, why are you buying that? Particularly if you live in Racine, because Racine has some of the highest rated water in terms of quality. Bottled water really was intended for emergency situations only, like Flint, Michigan,
right,
and other emergencies, weather emergencies and that sort of thing. So stop buying bottled water.
Well, and you're right, too, that it gets sold in these huge,
yes,
the 24 mm-hmm. bottles and 36 bottles and 48 bottles. I mean, it'd be interesting to be able to figure out a way to it, at the very least, curb that.
Yeah.
And stopping it altogether would be mm-hmm. would be really nice.
So often if you read the back of bottled water bottles, it tells you where the water comes from, and it might be New Jersey. Why do you need to drink New Jersey's water when we have perfectly good water here? That's, you know, seems a little strange. But
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's, I mean, and that's exactly the kind of thing that, because it's all around us and treated as a perfectly normal thing to do and maybe a good thing to do, it's just something that people are so inclined to do without stopping to kind of connect the dots and just looking at what they're doing in a really objective way.
Victims of one of the most successful marketing campaigns ever. Really, seriously. You know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thus ends the sermon
thus
for the day.
Thus ends that.
So, Callie, if people want more information about the Center for Sustainable Living and or want to be able to maybe access the resources or make use of it in some way, explain what they should do.
Sure. So we've got the website. It's Gateway's website, gtc.edu/sustainability. That'll take you to the Center for Sustainable Living as well as some of Gateway's other sustainable initiatives. There's also a Facebook page for the Center for Sustainable Living where I will post interesting sustainable lifestyle things as well as new events coming up at the center. So
very good. Very good. Well, it is a beautiful place. And again, just out of the way, the exact sort of place that is, in a sense, all too easy to miss, but it really shouldn't be missed. It's the kind of place that people need to seek out and just visit. It's beautiful and inspiring in so many different ways. And it's right here, literally in the backyard of our radio station here. And I hope people are intrigued by what they've heard, and if they've not visited the Center for Sustainable Living, that they will do so. Is it a place that people can just come visit, or should they be sort of making appointments first? I mean, what is your...
It's not always open. I am a part-time employee, so I'm not always up there. They're welcome to come whenever to walk the nature trail. Absolutely, please stop by. But the building itself won't be open unless I'm there, so call ahead.
Right. Sounds good. Can you give us the phone number?
Yeah, it's 262-564-2196.
Very good. Callie Johnson is the program manager for the Center for Sustainable Living on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. Callie, it was great to have you here on the program. Thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Nan, you have some events you want to tell us about.
I do. I have exciting events for people to know about. And the first one is at River Bend, May 15th at 6:30. It's a really special event. You'll be joining authors and National Geographic Adventurers of the Year, Amy and David Freeman, for an evening to remember. They'll be stopping at River Bend on their 1,750-mile book tour by bicycle from Ely, Minnesota to Washington, D.C., during which they're sharing their new book, A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters. And it's all about their continuing efforts to protect the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness from the threat of proposed copper mining. Additionally, when you attend this amazing event, you can sign the petition canoe that they're towing behind their bicycles and show your support for protecting Boundary Waters.
Wow.
It's cool, isn't it? Adventurers of the Year by National Geographic. That's really something. Here's a really beloved event in our community. Hawthorne Hollow on May 12th, Birds and Breakfast from 7 a.m. until 11. You can enjoy a hearty breakfast of pancakes, sausage, fresh fruit, and a beverage. While you're there, you can walk the trails and look for migrating birds with Hoy Audubon Society. Two Sisters Boutique will also be open along with their annual plant sale, in which you can buy a large variety of unique and native flora. And lastly, but certainly not finally, the Caledonia Conservancy will be holding a flower walk on May 12th at 10 a.m. You'll be joining Kay McClelland, who is one of the best native plant people out there, at the Short Road Trailhead for a walk in the woods to see beautiful spring ephemerals, and there's so many blooming right now. The Short Road Trailhead is located at 6111 Short Road, just north of 5 Mile Road. Wear walking shoes that can get dirty, bring your cameras, and come what see what the Conservancy lands have to offer you. And that's it.
Fantastic. Nan Calvert is with us once a month. And Nan, thank you for making today's program possible. We look forward to seeing you in the merry month of June.
Oh, as always, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's 8:57. This is the morning show on WGTD. Well, tomorrow's morning show originally was going to be featuring a new interview with a comedian, Paula Poundstone, and needless to say, I was tremendously excited about that. The interview was supposed to be recorded yesterday morning. Unfortunately, Paula Poundstone was forced to, needed to cancel that array of interviews scheduled for Wednesday because of illness, and so there is no Paula Poundstone for tomorrow. However, I'm going to be going into the archives and pulling out, for fun, some past interviews that I have done with the likes of Alan Alda and Bob Newhart. In the case of Alan Alda, it was because of a visit which he paid to Alverno College. And we had a wonderful, lengthy conversation about a book that he had written. And I am excited to share that interview, or at least most of it, with you on tomorrow's morning show. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And the program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. You will find morning